It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Listening to WFYI's Film Sociology. This is Film Sociology correspondent McKenna Mays, and I will be hosting the show today. Today I'm going to be talking with John Kroll, host of WFYI's No Limits. If you have any questions that you want to get to the show, you can email Matthew Sosi at msosi@wfyi.org. And I'm going to throw it back over to Matt.
Okay, you should really give the full disclosure on your guest. Go ahead.
All right, so I'll be talking to John Kroll. Like I said, host of No Limits here, and he's also the head of our journalism department at Franklin College, and I've had the pleasure of having him as a professor for the past 4 years.
John, did you already
pleasure
write in the...
Pleasure she did with air quotes there. So.
I say, John, did you write their evaluation?
So, I haven't graduated yet. I still have to be nice.
All right. Yeah, so McKenna, like I said, McKenna's been with me all semester, and I thought, oh, this would be a fun... I didn't really have a final exam. I'm doing also air quotes, and I thought, oh, let's have her host. This will be fun. So,
and she looks like she's having so much fun.
just put on your track shoes and keep up. It'll be fine.
Okay.
All right. Before we get into that, I do have a couple of notes here. Now I'm the correspondent this week. So a couple of films I need to catch up on because I think really McKenna interviewing John, and if there's time at the end of the show, she'll interview me. I think this is more interesting than the current home invasion thriller that opened or Melissa McCarthy's new comedy. You know that Melissa McCarthy comedy where she falls down?
Oh.
Yeah.
Never seen that before.
No. Well, apparently, now to be fair, apparently what I've seen about this one, it's her version of Back to School. So,
okay.
Yeah, take that. But there's a couple of films I do want to bring up I watched recently on video because they were sent to me. One was Curse of the Mayans, and this is a Mexican and American co-production. And it's a film, it's supposed to be based on a piece of apocalypse that's supposed to happen in the Mayan calendar in which Mayan creatures from space, stay with me on this, is going to invade the Earth and take human souls. So they get to that maybe in the last third, but the first third is we have really, really good-looking archaeologists and explorers of all kinds who have to travel down to Mexico and go into a sinkhole to find these Mayan ruins. It's part explorer story, part a lot of walking through caves and caverns, and then kind of bad zombie, bad alien body-snatching films. And it doesn't help, but the film is about 90 minutes, and it drags. It feels like it's twice as long. You've had those, hopefully not those 90-minute experiences. But anyway, that is out there. Somebody sent it to me. The other one is a film called In Between, and it tells the story of three Palestinian women all living in an apartment together, two of which are of the non-tradition. They are out for partying, and they let their hair fly, and crossed in with the more conservative in the head wrap. And what I like about, there are certain films, they are labeled as foreign films, but are the stories and are the characters universal? And that happens in this case, but we also have the elements of this, of a, obviously in Tel Aviv, a very male-dominated world. And what happens with the one traditional girl, conservative girl, who is happily engaged, or so we think, and what happens when the fiance, husband-to-be, winds up taking his power upon her and what the other girls do to help out. So it is. I don't see this being remade in the States, and that's really okay. It's not a wacky roommate movie, but it's an interesting look at the two different dynamics of the female character, of the female living in Tel Aviv, in modern-day Tel Aviv, so I should say. So anyway, that is out there. That is courtesy of Film Movement, everyone's favorite movie of the month club. And I do want to raise a glass to film editor Ann V. Coates, who passed away this week at the age of, I think, 92. She did a number of films in England in the 50s. Her big, big break, and I heard the story from TCM. She got two offers at the same time from big-name directors. She was asked to edit Stanley Kubrick's Lolita or David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh.
She picked David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia. And won an Academy Award. And it was kind of floating all over the internet. One of the all-time great, and I'm sure somebody has a list of this, of the great cinematic cuts. And it's Peter O'Toole blowing out the match, going to the desert. And it's interesting because years later, Kubrick would have a very similar shot in 2001 from The Bone to Outer Space. Her follow-up was an Academy Award nomination for Beckett. Other films of note include The Adventurers, Murder on the Orient Express, Man Friday, The Eagle Has Landed. She received another nomination for The Elephant Man, Pirates of Penzance, Greystoke, Lady Jane, Raw Deal. She went from a British costume drama to a Schwarzenegger film. Go where the work is. I Love You to Death, Chaplin, received another nomination for In the Line of Fire, Out to Sea, received another film nomination for editing for Out of Sight. And on behalf of a lot of guys and a lot of girls out there, and thank you for the scenes with George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez. Erin Brockovich, Unfaithful, and her last film, she edited the first 50 Shades of Grey film when she was 89 years old. And so not a bad career. So salute to Anne for that. So go check some of those out. Maybe not 50 Shades. Although I guess the joke was that her edits were too steamy. Too bad that, you know, she couldn't edit the script, but that's another time for theirs. All right, McKenna, I'm done with my stuff. The floor is yours.
All right. So, I actually moderated, but you two had your big epic Elvis chat that has not aired yet, but
soon.
Yes, you guys are in for a treat with that.
Yeah,
so,
the universe is waiting.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's thorough.
Yeah.
And if I need to go on vacation for 2 weeks, I got shows.
You do. You do.
But we talked about acting and his songs in the movies, but we didn't really touch on songs of his used in like current movies today.
Yeah.
So like Forrest Gump, Man on the Moon, Lilo and Stitch. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's good. I mean, he's a huge part of the American cultural landscape and really the world's cultural landscape now, because he's a major force. And for a long time, the Colonel Tom Parker, who was his manager, wouldn't let Elvis's music be used in movies. I mean, that perhaps the most poignant example of this is American Graffiti, you know, which is set in Southern California in the early 1960s, when Elvis was still all over the charts and was the biggest star in popular music. And, there's no Elvis in the soundtrack. Because Parker, the movie was made when Elvis was still alive and Parker was still managing things. And they said no.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, it's great. And I will say it's a lot of fun. Lilo and Stitch was the first movie I ever took my daughter to, who is now, a freshman in college. And I knew nothing about the movie other than it was Disney and that it was reasonably short and that it would be a good one for a very young girl at that point to go see in the theater. She'd been watching movies at home before that, but wanted to talk with her about theater etiquette and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I found out that the soundtrack was basically all Elvis, I thought, okay,
this
is serendipity here. It's the universe is talking to me.
Now, do you like modern covers of his songs, or do you just tend to stick to the original?
Oh, it depends upon who does the cover, of course. But some of them, yeah.
I
mean, there are, interpretations, and then you probably know there's a huge cottage industry now, and sort of stripping out his vocals and using new backings to them and creating new arrangements. Some of those are more effective than others. I'm a bit of a purist in that I you know, the Sun Studios stuff from the 50s, no, that is, you know, that is seminal and all of that. And I feel somewhat the same way, I think, about the Memphis recording studio stuff with Chips Moman. I thought that, you know, those recordings were just exquisite and probably shouldn't be messed around with a whole lot. But otherwise, yeah.
I think it's great. Like, I mean, you have Jimi Hendrix cover of Hound Dog, and that's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And then I really got introduced to Elvis through bands that, like, modern bands that I like covering his songs.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Fleet Foxes or Spiritualize, that's how I kind of got introduced to Elvis. So I think that's pretty cool. But where did you?
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. who, of course, originally recorded Hound Dog?
Oh, Big Mama!
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'll be over here
doing the blues. Well, and some of that though also illustrates it because, you know, one of the knocks when Elvis did it would apply to Jimi Hendrix as mm-hmm. well with Hound Dog. You listen to the lyrics, and admittedly, you know, Elvis turns it into basically an assault on polite society. You know, it is, it's a crescendo and, you know, the backstory on that is fascinating, but it's the lyrics are really about a woman indicting, the man who is her faithless lover. And, you know, so when a guy records that, it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Elvis, it was sort of a primal scream. I mean, he recorded that, if I remember correctly, like just the day after he'd done the Steve Allen show, and Steve Allen had dressed him up in a tuxedo and made him sing to a dog. And, you know, he was furious and humiliated about that, and you get all of that rage and frustration coming through in the recording.
Mm-hmm. So where did this love of Elvis come from?
Yeah, you know, I've tried to puzzle that out myself because I will say this. It was not cool to be an Elvis fan if you were a teenager in the mid-1970s, which is what I was. You know, I mentioned the first time I saw him was when the shows air, when I was about 8 years old and we were living in Marion, Ohio, and it was the first time I'd gotten to stay up late to watch a movie on a Friday night. Beyond that, you know, so much of it I found there is something so incredibly expressive in his voice that there is this quality of yearning that I don't think it ever really lost. At least spoke to me when I was very, very young, and I knew that I wanted a lot out of life, but I wasn't quite sure what that was mm-hmm. at the time, what those things were. And, you know, there are a whole lot of things about masculinity. I mean, he seemed to be able to combine being tough and sensitive and all of that, which were, you know, in those days, it seemed often you were encouraged to make one choice or the other, and I thought, why can't I have both?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know if that answers the question, but there is just something about him, and I think that, you know, at some point we can analyze art and artists, but there is something that is so, you know, ineffable about the connection you feel with an artist. It's sort of like explaining why you love your spouse or why you love your kids. Words fail at a certain point. It is simply you do.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents fans of Elvis too, or did you kind of just all find that on your own?
Oh, no.
No?
Well, I mean, they're sort of fans. You know, my father was much more Sinatra, and I've become a Sinatra fan and as I got older too. My mother was more into kind of country music, although not a lot. I was the only one in the family who really really listened to music a lot. And, you know, it was in those days it was important to have a stereo. And, of course, you listen to LPs or, you know, if you had the money and the patience and you were driving around, you might listen to 8-tracks in the car. which was not, by the way, a satisfying listening experience.
Not ideal. Now, did you ever kind of introduce your children to Elvis or try to get them to become fans?
Oh, well, they're sort of. They make fun, you know. But, you know, that's just the long, long list of many things they make fun of their father for. Because, you know, what's the point of having a father if you can't make fun of him?
That's true.
So, but, yeah, I mean, my daughter is a singer, and, you know, occasionally we'll sing along with some of the songs. My son, you know, loves to make fun of you know, sort of the Elvis caricature. Mm-hmm. So, but I'd say both of them have listened to the music. They know who he is.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Better than nothing.
Yeah.
But out of all of his albums and films, do you have a favorite of each?
Well, albums, it somewhat depends on the mood, you know, my mood at the time. I love From Elvis in Memphis, the, you know, the 69 comeback album. I love The Sun Sessions. I love Elvis's Back, which was the the album he did in 1960. I love the 68, the soundtrack to the 68 TV special. But there's a lot of things that, you know, I mean, even the mid-70s stuff, there's a great cut on an album from that was released in 75, I think recorded in 73 and 74, called Elvis Today. Well, several great cuts on that, but the one that speaks to those of us who have reached those middle years and are of mature vintage, called Pieces of My Life, that is a song about regret. There's another one on an album called Elvis Good Times, a cover of Loving Arms is just fabulous. So, mm-hmm. And, you know, the stuff he was doing even at the very end of his life, Hurt, Unchained Melody. I mean, guy still could perform until the very end.
Mm-hmm. And aside from Elvis, what other films or soundtracks kind of stood out to you when you were growing up?
Oh, what kind of movies that did I like when I was a kid? Well, boy, you know, my parents were lower middle class, so going to the movies was a big, big, big deal for us. As was going to McDonald's, by the way. When I'm of that vintage where I can remember, we would drive by the McDonald's and check, you know, when they would say how many millions of hamburgers have been served. You mm-hmm. could actually chart that. You know, the movies that we went to a lot of Disney when I was a kid. And I have fond memories just because they were associated with going with my family, Mary Poppins, The Sound of Music, and even forgettable Disney films like Follow Me, Boys, and The Adventures of Bullwhip Griffin, and all of that. The first films that I sort of got obsessed with, not surprisingly, were the James Bond films. The very first one I ever saw was Diamonds Are Forever. I saw that in the theater. And then in those days, you didn't see them on TV. You could not, you know, get even a VCR, much less DVD, and the Blu-rays now, which are fabulous at-home viewing experiences. So you had to wait until they came back in Rep Cinema. And, of course, if they were big films, they'd release them again periodically. So I remember being really fascinated with trying it. Diamonds Are Forever, I think, was the seventh film in the series, and catching up and seeing the other six earlier. And doing that. And then I remember my friends were obsessed with, you know, when Sean Connery definitely wasn't going to come back, who was going to be the next James Bond and that sort of stuff. And then, of course, you know, I mean, I was a teenager and, you know, came into my own spending money by working and all of that. When the sort of big spectacle movies, the Star Wars, Superman, a lot of those films came out, and those were huge. But I also remember seeing, I think, when I was in my late teens, a film that may still be my favorite overall, and that was Hal Ashby's Coming Home with John Voight and Jane Fonda and Bruce Dern, which, you know, it's now one of those films I don't think people talk about a whole lot. But seeing it, particularly if you have not seen it before, if you really kind of want to understand the human dynamics that people were facing during that Vietnam War era, that's a great, great movie, beautifully acted, and really, really wrenching to watch.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest. I don't think I've seen the majority of those, but what about you, Matt? What originally got you into film?
Actually, before that, I would say, because the year of Coming Home is also the year, it was the great Vietnam film competition.
Yes.
Because it was, you had Hal Ashby's very humanistic Coming Home up against Michael Cimino's almost operatic The Deer Hunter.
Which is a great film, too.
Yes. Don't watch them together. Not a double feature. Just don't. Anyway, my famous story was when I was five when I saw Jaws in a theater in Long Beach Island, New Jersey. My grandfather, who I thought was Ernest Hemingway minus the hole in the head, got up and left. I was like, wow. I mean, and it absolutely terrified me. And the very next day, my father, the humanitarian that he is, took me to the beach, lifted me up over his head, walked toward the water, and just hummed two notes. And those who know, you know, the most famous two notes probably in cinematic soundtrack history, and scared the daylights out of me. Could not. I'm laughing now. That's good. Could not get into the water for a while. And looking back, that was a piece of celluloid.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a film. It was a movie. And, you know, we were told later it's just a movie. You know, but being terrified of that, I remember bawling my eyes out when Rocky lost.
Oh, yeah.
And my mom explaining that he won in his own way. And of course, I was too young to comprehend. Like, no, he didn't, Mom. Shut up. He didn't, you know. So just that dynamic. I remember seeing Halloween when I was eight with my dad and my older brother. I'm okay, by the way. But, you know, the first time watching it in Jaws, with the through the eyes. But it was also the first time I was at a scary movie and I heard people laughing. And I didn't understand that. So Pop, my dad, was one of those that kind of sat me down and watched stuff. I watched a lot of stuff that my parents, especially my dad, watched. I mean, they dragged, they took me to the 70s children's fair, but I think they really wanted to see stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And my dad was really good at explaining it to me why Fredo wasn't the best of the Corleone family. And this was at home, by the way.
Yeah.
Casablanca, I remember watching that with him. The Marx Brothers and Monty Python, which is great when you're five. You get all the physical stuff, all the visual gags. And then as you get older, the PBS station in my hometown of Flint, Michigan, they would air the Holy Grail every year on TV. In fact, I had somewhere like a Betamax copy of it with the giant pledge break. And as I got older, you understood things better. You know, when I was 12, I wanted to be in the castle Anthrax. And then by the time I was 17, I understood the communist peasant. You know, the art hasn't changed. I've changed. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just became kind of a movie nut.
Well, and that's the other part of that question you asked about why you respond to something, too, is if it is really, really profound, you can come back to it and experience different things because you change through life. You know, it's not just the music, but the movies, books that I love, they're all different experiences as I move to different points in my life, and they have different things to teach to me, and they speak to me in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I always think The Big Chill should be watched every 5 years.
Yeah.
I was 13 when that film came out, and all I got at the time was really good acting, vulnerable grown-ups. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got that again when I was 18. When I was 25, I had a classmate commit suicide, so that resonated a little bit. And then jobs, marriage, family, it hasn't changed. Nobody changed the film, Spielberg and Lucas, but yeah, I think that's one. And it was graduation weekend for some. If you get a chance, there's a wonderfully underrated film called Fandango. It was the first film directed by Kevin Reynolds, and it started then unknown Kevin Costner. This was before Silverado, and it's him and Judd Nelson was the big name at the time. This was also before The Breakfast Club, but it's five guys, graduation weekend in Austin, Texas, 1971, the weekend before the draft, and they go on a road trip. And it was Spielberg's Amblin Studios put it out. And it looks like, on the trailers, it looks like the horny teenager film, but it's way, way more than that. And a great soundtrack. Blind Faith, Cream, Best Use of Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting by Elton John, It's Too Late by Carole King. I always think of that film with those songs.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of soundtracks, are there any like film soundtracks that really stand out to you?
Oh, well, you know, part of it is that I don't have the same, because, and part of what happened starting in the 70s was this idea of cross-marketing, too, that the movies became a way to sell songs, starting really with Saturday Night Fever, and to some degree American Graffiti, but Saturday Night Fever was the one that really exploded and became like the biggest seller for two or three years around it, and all of that. So for me, it's more, I think, okay, is this music really to set the mood, or is it to simply a marketing decision they're making? I will admit there are certainly, the Lawrence of Arabia soundtrack, for example, is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I think Rocky in some ways is also another one. You can't imagine the movie without it. Indiana Jones, and for bringing back to the first films that I adult kind of films that I ever got obsessed with, the whole James Bond theme is huge.
I would say, because you had John Barry's score, of course, and then like who was going to do it? It was Shirley Bassey or Paul McCartney Wings. I remember that was a huge leap, because they had gone from crooners, male and female, to a band with Paul. I also remember I thought I got the original soundtrack score to Star Wars, and it was not the John Williams score. It was some other. That which happens quite a bit. I remember, there would be the good, the bad, and the ugly. But it was Hugo Mortensen instead of Ennio Morricone. So there's a bit of cross pollination there.
Yeah, but music's an essential part of film, so it's part of the experience.
That there's always they often say, and some of my fellow critics have said this, and others have, that if you don't notice the music is doing its job. But I think there are also exceptions to that rule, like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, like the music and like that Hans Zimmer does in Inception, where it's kind of hitting you over the head. But I actually didn't mind getting hit over the head with that, or the music Morricone uses for the shootout at the end of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is one of my favorite moments in film.
Well, or sometimes you use it like in the theater, the Greeks would have used the chorus or whatever, which, I'm thinking the example that comes to mind there is in the George Clooney film Good Night and Good Luck, where really they cut and you can tell, it's either being foreshadowed or there's a comment that is being offered on what has just happened here.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know how into Edgar Wright films you guys are, but I think he always does a great job with his music. Scott Pilgrim is one of my favorite films, and he had Beck do most of the music for that, if not all the music. And it's just got a really great vibe. It's got like this White Stripes punk thing that I think is really awesome. And then, Baby Driver too.
Yeah, my daughter wants Baby Driver on vinyl. I've recently got it on disc because I'm behind the times. But what Edgar Wright does with, first off, the best use of a song by Queen ever in a film is "Don't Stop Me Now," used in Shaun of the Dead. I don't need you can keep Bohemian Rhapsody and Flash Gordon. I like that. But what he did in Baby Driver was, he picked out song pieces to go into beat with the action. Mm-hmm. You know, the guns shot in this scene and guns shot. And of course, a great example is the use of the original recording of Harlem Shuffle in the opening sequence. Mm-hmm. He picks out. There was also, and I think Tarantino had a lot to do with this, was acceptable to have a wide variety of genres mm-hmm. in one collection, in one album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen many of the films, so I'm not as knowledgeable. And my children, if they were sitting here, would be, you know, shaking their heads and saying, oh, you know, Dad, why don't you listen to something that's been recorded in the last two centuries? But, you know, so I'm not sure I can add much to that. And I don't get to see as many movies now in the theaters. And that's sort of the way I miss that because movies are at some level a communal experience. You gain something by being with the audience. And there is something to be said for hearing the soundtrack, too, with a really, really great sound system.
Mm-hmm.
And I might add, it can be a disorienting. I mean, I remember one of the weirdest experiences of my life. When I first started working in the newspaper business, I went back to St. Louis, where I'd gone to grad school, to visit friends at the end of, like, a brutal 90-hour week. So I got there, and they said, we want to go see Apocalypse Now, which was at the Tivoli, which is a great rep cinema. It was a great rep cinema in University City, which is sort of to the west of St. Louis. And we get there. I'd seen the movie before on a small screen, not on the big screen, so I hadn't had that experience. But I was so exhausted because I'd gotten maybe 5 hours sleep in the past 4 days that we get there, and I'm watching, and then finally the head nods, and I fall asleep. And when I woke up, it's in one of the scenes where everything is breaking loose. The soundtrack was overwhelming in there. And for a space of about 5 seconds, I had no idea where I was and all of that. And I just remember being completely freaked out. Why is all of this going on around me? And then it clicked back in, and I could say that, you know, that point that Matt was, that it's only a movie, but... You know, until you sort of will yourself back into that space, it's a really powerful, and the music and all of that, the soundtrack, was an overwhelming part of that experience.
Note to Franklin students, don't be a smart aleck and play Ride of the Valkyries behind John. That's not nice.
It'll
it's not funny.
Yes, yes.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Well, I remember my dad, and I have to give my father a lot of credit for going to see stuff, and it was also, or letting me tag along with him, watching sneak previews back when Siskel and Ebert were on PBS. That's how far back I go, in 1979. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing Kagamusha. It was the first time I'd seen a Kurosawa film in the theater, and it actually came to a suburb of Flint. And Dad went with me, and he had had a kind of a 16-hour day at the operating table and fell asleep. I had to fill them in as best I could, but it was when I was like, yeah, when it came out on video. Like,
Japanese was a little tricky, Dad.
A little bit.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
I also think that's something that's really cool. If you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy or any of those types of movies, the whole 80s soundtrack is really, like, phenomenal. The songs that they put in there. So Bowie and Fleetwood Mac.
You mean the current hits?
Yeah, the current hits, definitely.
And 70s.
Yeah, and 70s.
Yeah.
But with the soundtrack, they're also bringing back cassette tapes. They're actually putting the soundtrack on cassette tapes, and those are selling now. I mean, you've had your reemergence of vinyl again, but...
I'm going to ask this as one of the elders on this side of the studio. Are people really doing the cassette thing?
Yeah, people are really, like, buying, like, the portable,
like,
Walkmans.
Your age?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to be on the front stoop, John. I'm going to be...
I was going to say, yeah, It is, although, you know, one of the things, and I kind of scoffed at people before I got into radio and had to spend, it seems like a disproportionate amount of time with headphones attached to my ears, listening to, to specific sounds and all of that. But there is a difference. I mean, the LPs, it is a much warmer sound than you get digitally.
Yep.
And it's... Yeah, and that makes a difference for particularly with certain kinds of music or whatever, that that experience is just so much more, you know, full.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I think you, well, cassettes are better than A-tracks. I think we're definitely square on that. I have not really done a warmth.
Nails across the blackboard are better than A-tracks.
I have not done a warmth comparison between cassettes and MP3s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite there yet. But yeah, I still, it's 2018 and I still play compact disc. And part of it is we have the equipment and the reliability of it. So, I mean, it's great that if there's more vinyl out there. I wish we had players and the money to go with those. I just don't know if I'm going to do that converting like we had to from VHS to disc to Blu-ray.
Well, and that's some of what, you know, you find over the years. I've lost track of how many movies, for example, and that I've bought first in VHS, then to DVD, and then going to Blu-ray, because if you love them, you love them, and you want to see them. Similarly, that's been the case with music. Now, a lot of my old LPs I've kept, but they make them better now, too. The vinyl is much thicker, much more scratch-resistant than the old stuff, because that was one of the nightmares of listening to music, you know, in the 60s and 70s. Is that the records often would become scratched, and then you'd sort of have to listen and think, oh, okay, we're coming up on that part that's going to drive me crazy. I'll tune out for a second. The other thing is, I remember being a college DJ at Franklin years ago. Yeah, and, you know, in the days when you still had to cue it up manually, that could be difficult. It could be tricky, particularly I remember once in the very, very old Franklin College radio station, we only had two turntables, and one of them was out of commission for a couple of weeks. So trying to figure out how you queued up the next song was a nightmare.
Yeah, you didn't want to push play and hear it.
Yeah,
it morphs into regular speed.
Yeah, I just remember thinking, okay, let's pick albums here with really, really long cuts.
Yeah, at Ball State at WCRD, second year of the student run radio station, not BST. That's too highbrow. But we had two turntables, and we still had cassettes. I mean, not 8-tracks, but we still had those big old things that clock
boy.
In. Yeah, those and cassette players if needed. But yeah, and then that it was a big deal when a compact disc player was purchased.
Oh yeah,
huge purchase. So.
Mm-hmm. And with most vinyls that you get today, they usually have a digital download, which is cool, so you can take the music on the go as well. But So when you were a DJ at Franklin, was that as a student or?
Yeah, I was a student. Yeah. I was a student. It was, you know.
Are there pictures?
I'm interested.
Oh, there are probably horrifying photos from that period, you know, that you know ought to come with parental warnings. It was a fun experience, and that was part of, you know, what I hope is still the Franklin College experience. You know, because it was a small place then and it's still a small place now, you could try on an awful lot of identities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, during my time there, I started my own alternative newspaper. I was a radio DJ. I acted in some plays. You know, I did all sorts of things that, you know, ended up not necessarily being the life path I was going to pursue. But they were fun, and they gave me a certain appreciation for what other people experience when they do those things, and certainly helped me as a journalist because I could empathize a lot more.
Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to come back to Franklin and teach?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, when the directorship of the Pulliam School of Journalism became available, one of my predecessors, who also had been one of my professors at Franklin College, called me. I was getting ready to leave the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, where I'd been the executive director, called me and encouraged me to apply for the directorship of the PSJ. And this is Bill Bridges. And I looked at Bill and I said, Bill, you know, I'm... my experience has prepared me for an awful lot of things, but I'm not sure academia is necessarily among them. I love the place and all of that, but anyhow, so kind of left it at that. But Bill has denied this, but I think there has to be some connection. After that, a woman named Charlene Jacobs, who's no longer living, who is the widow of Harvey Jacobs, whom we give an award away in honor of every year at the PSJ Awards Dinner. Harvey was my mentor. He hired me at the Indianapolis News when I was not yet 22 years old, made me first a member of the editorial board and then a columnist for the paper, taught me an awful lot of what I know about writing and whatever I might know about leadership. Charlene called me, and she took me to lunch, and she talked with me about the job and said, you know, and then as we're at the end and getting ready to break, I remember she grabbed my hand and she looked at me and she said, "Harvey would want you to do this." And I thought, okay. But as usual, Harvey was looking out for me. It's been a great move. It's been incredibly satisfying. I've been thrilled because I get to work with young people such as yourself. I've got a great crew of colleagues down there, and we've sort of expanded the Franklin College universe. You know, we get to do things like that, work with people like Matt and the great folks here at WFYI. So that's the more specific one. The other one I hope people would think of as well in their own lives. I came back because Franklin College made a difference in my life, and I felt like, you know, it took some chances on me when not a lot of other people were willing to do so. And I think there is something, you know, there's an obligation that comes with that. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to take care of the people in the places who take care of you.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've been in the journalism field for a while now, and there have been numerous...
You're being polite here.
Being polite.
Stone tablets.
Yeah, I was going to say, I interviewed Moses. That's, you know... Yeah.
But there have been numerous films about journalism that have come out, some really great ones actually recently with Spotlight and The Post. Have you seen any ones that have really stood out to you or something that you think has a really good message about journalism?
Well, I love the ones that actually get what journalism is about. Mm-hmm. You know, The Post, Spotlight are great films that, you know, the Spotlight really reflects the era in which I was working as a newspaper reporter, and what I saw in that film, I thought, oh, yeah, that's a newsroom. That's the way these things work. The Post obviously was a different kind of take on the All the President's Men story and Watergate in that era. And as such, you know, there's not a whole lot we get that emphasizes the risks that the people who own the paper and who have to deal with boards and all of that have to take in situations like that, the kind of pressure that they were under. So I love those movies. I'm not a huge fan of the movies where, you know, nobody ever seems to write anything, or, you know, comes up with a story that no paper would run. I think perhaps the one that almost got me to get up and leave the theater was St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh, God.
if you remember that from one of the Brat Pack movies from the 80s, when in theory they were starting to grow up. And Andrew McCarthy's character is an aspiring newspaper reporter. And, you know, relatively late in the film, one of the other characters says, "Oh, look," Andrew's character's first story has been published in the paper. And they cut to it, And it's right in the middle of a news section, and it says the meaning of life. And I thought, I bet they did an extra press run on that one and all of that.
Actually, tying back into Ann Coates, actually. And I remember we talked about this on your show, and I almost embarrassed John on the spot. For me, the biggest sin of the film 50 Shades of Grey is not all the stuff that it's known for, but the setup is the Dakota Johnson character is the roommate of a journalism student who is supposed to interview Christian Grey. Her roommate takes ill, and Dakota Johnson goes in her place. That's an expulsion. You're expelled for doing that. That for me was a bigger sin than all the whips and chains and other nonsense that has happened in that film. But I
hate to tell you, you're telling me far more about these books and movies than I ever really cared to know.
I also learned to say, you know what, John? This film reminded me. I thought of you when I saw. Don't say that. That's not a good thing to say.
I was going to say. Hope my wife is not listening here. So
she'll just pat me on the head. Well, hit me and then give you a cookie and go on your way.
I know you have to take off soon, but there is one more question that I wanted to get to. The class of 2018, we are graduating in about a week. Is there any advice that you would give to the graduating journalism students?
And I think I would say this to just about any young person. Focus on the work, and the career takes care of itself. If you do good work, if you look around for things that interest you, that have meaning to you, you got to pay the bills and all of that. And that's a large part of the challenge of life is figuring out how you can get someone to pay you a decent amount of money to do things that you otherwise would want to do anyhow. And, I'm not going to say follow your passion or your bliss, because there's a large part of any job that is just work. But it's got to be satisfying to you at the end of the day, because the reality is, for most people, money, once you get above, suppose you're phenomenally successful and you make $5 or $10 million. Well, what's $10 million going to buy you that you really need that $5 million wouldn't already, or some such like that? So you got to figure that stuff out. But really, it is pay attention to the work you're doing, and those choices, other choices, will become much more clear. I never had a career plan. I still don't have one. But I've always been able to do work that I found interesting, that had meaning to me, and I've had a really, really good life.
Mm. All right.
Well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate talking with you.
Door's always open for you here, John. You know that.
Great. Thanks much.
All right. When we come back after the break, now stick around. You're going to love this. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI. I want to thank John for coming in and having a chat with me. That was really nice. And now I'm going to talk a little bit with Matthew, and I think he's going to introduce some midnight movies and drive-in stuff.
Yeah, I still have a little bit of control over the show. Not really. Have you been to a drive-in?
Not a drive-in, because I live in, like, the middle of nowhere, and we don't really have that stuff. But we did watch American Sniper in my best friend's, well, not my best friend, one of my friend's driveways on a projector, so if that counts.
No, but it's a start. So I know there is one on the border north of Cincinnati. You just have to find
it. It's around there somewhere.
Right. Okay. At the Tibbs Drive-In. Oh, this one's for the ladies, apparently. Life of the Party and I Feel Pretty. And apparently, go to the AV Club, and apparently you can follow. There's a great thread of Greta Gerwig commenting on I Feel Pretty in the theater. So that's out there. Screen 2, Breaking In and Truth or Dare. Two thrillers. Okay. PG thrillers, by the way. Screen 3, Avengers Infinity War and Rampage. And then Screen 4, A Quiet Place, and Super Troopers 2. Okay. And at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, Avengers Infinity War, and Blockers. Yeah. Okay. Now, midnight movies. So just mark your calendars on this. They start up at the Keystone Art Cinemas on June 8th and 9th, Big Trouble in Little China. You know what? John Carpenter film with Kurt Russell and Kim Cattrall, and it's a trip. 15th and 16th, the extended edition of Suspiria, which they are apparently are remaking for this year. Fine Italian thriller there. The 22nd and 23rd, Spirited Away, for you Miyazaki fans. The 29th and the 30th, The Room, which means, yes, You'll be hearing my Tommy Wiseau interview, and I have to say, McKenna got me as a last week graduation gift the definitive guide to The Room. So, my family will look at you with great disdain. July 6th and 7th, Jaws, which we talked about before. July 13th and 14th, Mean Girls, now a musical. July 20th and 21st, Stop Making Sense, which I would recommend checking out. I remember the first concert film from director Jonathan Demme. And then the 27th, 28th of July, Akira. So that is all happening at the Midnight Movies at Keystone Arts. So.
What was your first midnight movie?
Rocky Horror.
Same.
And this was in the 80s, and that was really... there weren't a lot of midnight movies in Michigan. I mean, they were still happening in Chicago, still happening in New York. But yeah, seeing Rocky Horror at a midnight movie was an exhilarating experience. I remember, especially when I was older, it would be days where I would still find raw rice kernels in my hair. I had big hair then as well. But that was the only one in town. So I remember, but I'd heard stories that there were other midnight movies like Pink Flamingos and Freaks and, 2001. But that, and I think the college campus would have those, but that was about it. But no, Rocky Horror was the start, and then it kind of escalated from there. Have you done one? Have you done midnight movies?
Yeah, I did Rocky Horror at the Irving when I was about, I think it was freshman year of college, actually.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Yep. They had you like get down and do the time warp and everything.
Yes.
And they had the people acting along, and it was really fun.
I think, you have not seen The Room live yet.
No, not
live. We need to work on that. But there is this kind of weird outlet. The other part is there's also there is kind of a structure. I grew up in Flint, Michigan. There was a mall theater in Utica, Michigan, which is near Pontiac. So it was kind of between Flint and Detroit. But they would air Rocky Horror every weekend. And if I was coming home from a concert or a ball game and I was not exhausted, I would go there and watch. And some groups were great and they knew what to say, when to say it. Other times, like I remember seeing it for the first time at Ball State, and it was just a bunch of farm kids making homophobic remarks at Tim Curry. Mm-hmm. And it was not fun. And then if you're the only one who does the dialogue, you feel like you're carrying the weight of the theater. And that's not a fun experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely better to have everyone with you.
Right. And The Room is still, and also with Rocky Horror, that's, we're talking 40 years where you've been able to hone and develop. And some riffs come and go. And I think The Room is still developing its what needs to be said. So it's been fun to hear what is said and what has not been said with a live crowd.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other one that I did, and you can't judge me because I was only like 12 or 13.
Oh, I can judge you, all right.
You can't judge me.
Okay, all right.
But we went and saw Twilight whenever it would open, like the night before. So
you
at
were a 13-year-old girl. I'm not going to.
Okay, good.
Although, have you watched Riff Track's treatment of Twilight?
No, I don't think so.
You really should.
Okay.
Maybe after the show. With a group? You saw it with a group?
Yeah, usually some of my friends, and then I think my mom tagged along a couple times.
Were y'all squealing?
Yep. We had our Team Jacob, Team Edward shirts on. Oh, it was the whole package. We were ready to go.
Okay. All right. My daughter kind of dodged that bullet. And,
fortunately, that's good.
Of course, former, well, she's not really former. She's always here. But Bianca Slagle was the Twilight correspondent of the show many years ago. So all of them. You got through all, you read all of them, you watched all of them?
Read all of them, watched three of them. And then I kind of got out of that phase.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So this is like, it's like going from your, going from Selena Gomez to Sarah McLachlan.
Yeah.
Or Joni Mitchell, if you're really old. So that when you're making that transition from pop to serious music, when you're going from ogling boys to men or girls to women. But yeah, okay, that's fine. Wow. Full House, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I can't fathom that. Mm-hmm. Any guys there?
Maybe
boyfriends
yeah,
drag there.
That's about it, I think.
And how about suburban moms drooling over an underage boy?
Yeah, that was weird. That's something I kind of reflected on, and I was like, ooh.
See, I remember having to review The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants at a 10 o'clock screening at Glendale, and I was the only old person there, and I felt really uncomfortable. And I remember saying on the radio, I was like, by the way, I was there for work. I don't want anybody to say, yeah, the movie was good, but there was this old guy by himself. So anyway, it's nice to know that moms can be just as unsettling as old dads. Mm-hmm. So there is that. There is a place in Chicago called the Music Box. They still do midnight movies every week. They do matinees on Saturday and Sunday mornings at 11, which is a lot of fun. So, you know, midnight movies are still out there. I have no problem with a big screen in your house, but as John said, you know, there is that communal feeling. So the fact that Rocky Horror happens here once a month at the Irving, and we got the midnight movies at Keystone Arts, and even the drive-ins, and of course the IMA has stuff. So, you know, the theater is still a gathering place, even at the multiplexes. So, mm-hmm. you know, hopefully that can be that you have that experience.
Mm-hmm. So what have you seen recently?
Well, I didn't see any. Well, I really didn't want to see Melissa McCarthy's new film or the home invasion thriller, but I did. So I'm about a week behind. Hopefully I'll catch up next week. Mm-hmm. But I did see Tully. The third collaboration between Jason Reitman and Diablo Cody. It's not a trilogy per se, but there you could see aspects of it. I love Juno. I'm one of those that really liked young adult. She's a despicable character, I know, and she's got problems. And this one deals with, obviously, the plight of motherhood and what happens when the kind of cinematic dream nanny shows up. And it's not Mary Poppins. There is a moment that happens once in, it's just, you want to go with it. And I did, and I didn't mind the turns and twists that happened near the last third of the film. I think Theron's fine. I'm sure there are women that will, like my friend Charlene, who's, you know, shooting daggers at that picture, but, it's a different look at motherhood. That's not, well, it kind of says right out the gate, parenting can suck. As opposed to the cinematic woe is me, you know, films like This Is 40 and Book Club, which I'm really not looking forward to, of either comically cartoonish, feisty old people or I'm not hip anymore, woe is me. I have very low tolerance for that. Mm-hmm. So, well, McKenna, you survived.
I did.
So I guess I'm going to share this with you. I appreciate you doing this. This is not a part of your internship, but I'm glad you got to do it.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
All right. So, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Ready? Actually, repeat after me. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Some words to live by.
Some words to live by.
Silent breed is people.
Zardoz has spoken.
McKenna, always a pleasure. You still have, I think, an interview that needs to air with Brothers Keeper and the great Elvis film breakdown with John Krull will be coming soon. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!